Hello and welcome to BURST CME Oncology Consultations, Epithelioid Sarcoma, Applying Clinical Updates to Real Patient Cases. On behalf of Physicians Education Resource, thank you for joining us. I am Dr. Mark Ogolnik. I am a sarcoma medical oncologist at Keck Medicine of USC in Los Angeles, California, and I am honored to be joined today, and I welcome Dr. Shayna Rosell. And would you mind introducing yourself for us?
Hi, I'm Dr. Shayna Rosell. I am a hematologist-oncologist with a private practice called Affiliated Oncology in Southland of Chicago.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. During this program, we will discuss the current and emerging differential diagnosis and management of epithelioid sarcoma. We will start with an overview of the current standard of care in epithelioid sarcoma, focusing on optimal treatment selection to optimize delivery of patient care as the treatment landscape continues to evolve. Case-based discussions will help to place the data into clinical context and provide insight into integrating these strategies into clinical practice. I will now highlight these data and present a patient case for discussion with Dr. Rosell. So let's talk about the clinical efficacy and safety of current and emerging epithelioid sarcoma therapies. So what we know is that an epithelioid sarcoma patient has a rare aggressive soft tissue neoplasm that is characterized by nodular aggregates of epithelioid cells. It is a rare subtype of soft tissue sarcomas that could originate in any anatomic location and predominantly affects young adults. There are two distinct variants. We have classic ES, which typically presents in the distal extremities, and proximal ES, which is more aggressive and occurs in the proximal limbs and the trunk. There are certain markers and genetic features that are indicative of the disease and help categorize the disease and establish the diagnosis. We know that epithelioid sarcomas are categorized by the deletion of SMARCB1 and loss of INI1 expression, which are critical for diagnosis and differentiation from other diagnoses. Various genetic and epigenetic mechanisms can result in loss of INI1 expression, but that leads to an unopposed constitutively active oncogenic activation of EZH2, an enzyme that trimethylates lysine 27 of histone H3. And it's this loss of INI1, SMARCB1, or both, that is the molecular hallmark of an epithelioid sarcoma. The National Comprehensive Cancer Network, or NCCN, recommends tazemetostat, which is an EZH2 inhibitor, as the preferred treatment for advanced epithelioid sarcoma, and this is a Category 2A recommendation. The clinical efficacy and safety of tazemetostat, both as a monotherapy and in combination with doxorubicin, have been evaluated in several studies for the treatment of advanced epithelioid sarcoma. Let's first talk about tazemetostat as a monotherapy. This is a first-in-class oral selective inhibitor of EZH2 and was well tolerated and showed encouraging activity in a phase 1 study involving patients with advanced solid tumors that had a loss of INI1 or SMARCB1. Tazemetostat was then evaluated in a phase 2 basket study involving 62 patients with advanced epithelioid sarcoma. Eligible patients in this cohort were age 16 years of age or older with a histologically confirmed locally advanced or metastatic epithelioid sarcoma. Patients were required to have documented loss of INI1 expression by immunohistochemical analysis, biallelic SMARCB1 alterations, or both. Tazemetostat 800 milligrams was administered orally twice per day in continuous 28-day cycles until disease progression, unacceptable toxicity, or withdrawal of consent. What we saw from a result standpoint is the study reported an objective response rate of 15% with a median progression-free survival of 5.5 months and a median overall survival of 19 months. The treatment was generally well tolerated, with the most common grade 3 or worse treatment-related adverse event being anemia or weight loss. If we look at these and we start on the top left-hand side, we see the change in the sum of the target lesions from baseline, and we see that the majority of patients have stabilization or improvement of their disease. When we look at the bottom, we see the overall treatment duration for patients. The top right-hand side is our overall survival. And then on the bottom right-hand side, we see progression-free survival for patients. Subsequent to this, we could also have combination therapy of tazemetostat with doxorubicin. And so the phase 1b study assessed the combination of tazemetostat with doxorubicin in patients with advanced soft tissue sarcoma, including epithelioid sarcomas. The recommended phase 3 dose of tazemetostat was determined to be 800 milligrams twice daily in combination with doxorubicin 75 milligrams per meter squared, IV on day 1 of each cycle for up to 6 cycles. The combination was generally well tolerated with dose-limiting toxicities, including febrile neutropenia. And here, the most common grade 3 or 4 treatment-related adverse events were neutropenia, anemia, and fatigue. Subsequently, there is an ongoing phase 1b/3 trial, which aims to further evaluate the safety and efficacy of tazemetostat combined with doxorubicin as frontline therapy for advanced epithelioid sarcoma. Preliminary results from the phase 1b portion indicate that the combination is feasible and has a manageable safety profile, with the recommended phase 3 dosing established for further investigation in the phase 3 trial. When we think about alternative therapies to targeted therapies for this disease, we know that chemotherapy remains an option for our patients, but it is associated with significant toxicity. And further research into targeted therapies and immunotherapy is ongoing to improve outcomes for patients with this aggressive cancer. So let's move on to a case. So here we have Dr. Rozelle and I did share a case, and maybe I'll have you present the case if that's okay.
So this is a 40-year-old male with a history of coronary artery disease, hypertension, and diabetes, who presents to the clinic with worsening fatigue and unintentional weight loss. On exam, this reveals a firm 2-centimeter lesion on his left forearm with surrounding bruising. A biopsy confirms a diagnosis of epithelioid sarcoma, and staging scans show metastases to the brain and regional lymph nodes.
So Dr. Rozelle and I have had the opportunity to work together for many years in a collaboration between community and academia. Could you maybe talk a little bit about what is the benefit for patients to staying within a community practice? We certainly know what it is, but I think it would be great if we could share for the audience.
Absolutely. So working in the community allows them to be closer to home. I think one of the barriers with going to tertiary centers or academic centers is that patients have to travel far and long distances. Besides that, there are a lot of socioeconomic factors that play into receiving treatment, such as transportation. Also, parking may be a little bit more expensive in these tertiary centers. And so most patients prefer to stay at home where they are close. They are able to have loved ones at their bedside. And so they would rather stay at home with their primary providers.
Is it fair to say for patients with common diseases that clinical trial opportunities exist both in academic practices as well as community practices?
Absolutely. Even in my private practice, we do collaborate with other institutions and we do conduct clinical trials.
So now let's say this patient presented. And so we know that this is a 40-year-old male. We know that the brain metastases need to be addressed first, and those will be addressed similar to other ways that we address brain metastases. But now that we talk about a patient with treated brain metastases who has metastatic disease and has a rare condition, how would you approach the patient with respect to trying to understand if there is a clinical trial available for him?
Yes, absolutely. So in these rare cases and unusual presentations, I definitely first, I do my own preliminary research. And so I may actually go look it up. I look at NCCN guidelines. I look at, you know, wide resources such as UpToDate where other oncologists may look at. And then I start to do my research as far as looking at other opportunities for clinical trials. So this may be reaching out, for instance, to you to see if there is anything available as you are my right and handy sarcoma expert. Or it may be also looking at collaborating institutions that I may have an affiliation with, or if I know other physicians in that area.
So essentially, you need someone on speed dial.
Absolutely.
Okay, so assuming I have a clinical trial for this patient, are you comfortable sending the patient to the academic centers for the clinical trials?
I am. And with that being said, it's because of that relationship, I don't have a fear that that patient will return back home. I think some of the barriers with referring out to tertiary centers is that many providers think they'll lose those patients and that they won't return back. But when you do have a relationship or you have a mentor that you've collaborated with for years, you don't really have that fear.
I mean, what's often nice about these situations, I imagine, for community oncologists is when you treat the community, you could be treating his aunt for breast cancer, or you could be treating this patient's next door neighbor. And so, if you're part of a community, it's very nice. You have this built-in respect that automatically develops, and the patient feels comfortable, and it's less intimidating than when they come to the academic centers, where I do find that they sort of it's almost a deer in headlight approach sometimes because it is overwhelming compared to seeing someone in a community that you know that other loved ones have worked with in the past. For this patient, we didn't have a clinical trial. And so what we ended up doing was discussing the use of tazemetostat for the patient and talk a little bit about how comfortable you were with starting a drug that you perhaps not used before for other conditions.
Oh, absolutely. So I am that robust, young, spry oncologist who is willing to try anything. I think it's more about becoming familiar. If you don't try something, you'll never become familiar with it. And so I think that is when collaborating with, for instance, you or anyone else and having a conversation about things to expect, also doing my own research, I will try the medication.
And we know this was a good medication for the patient. There's obviously a concern that the patient at age 40 has other comorbidities, including coronary artery disease, hypertension, diabetes. Talk a little bit about oncology in general. When you see these patients that have comorbidities, does that prevent them from having other therapies, or does it just allow you to be more cognizant of what the side effect profile is and how to manage them?
When I'm treating patients with medical comorbidities, I do not exclude them from any potential life-saving therapies. I do believe I am a little bit more attentive, and so I am monitoring them a little bit more closely than would someone be who's extremely healthy. Just for instance, we have a cardiac oncologist, even in our private care practice, where I refer to if they have medical comorbidities such as receiving anthracyclines, where they may have decreased heart failure. So I do believe in collaboration. I do believe in allowing patients to have that same benefit that anyone else has. And so with that being said, I just would monitor them a little bit more closely.
It would be a shame, don't you agree, if someone judged this patient based on their comorbidities and restricted therapies that could be safely given in a more controlled environment.
Absolutely.
So here the patient did go on tazemetostat. We discussed the adverse events that the patient can potentially have. You monitored them for it and actually got him through very well on these treatments. We spoke many times about are there second line, third line clinical trials and what else is available. And I think the patient really did benefit from a very good relationship between us. We did it over the phone, we did it by texting. And I think having us partner allowed the patient to offset some of the burden. And talk to me about how our relationship makes you feel when you're presenting to the patient, because you're presenting on behalf of both of us. And do you feel
Yes.
comfortable doing that?
Yes, I do. I think for me, my goal was to come back and to do the community work. And with that being said, training in academia, and allowing me to be that bridge, allows me to promote both myself as well as you, in taking care of these patients. And so I don't believe that every patient will be allowed to receive that care at tertiary centers. And so who do we have out there to be that bridge to connect patients and to receive that care? That's who I represent.
Correct. How lucky the patients are that they have these opportunities. As the patient progresses and has scans done, let's talk a little bit about the diagnosis and the biopsy. So the patient did have a biopsy done at your institution. When biopsies are done in their very rare conditions, so this isn't a common breast cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer. Talk
Yes.
to me about what your discussions are like with the pathologist and how do you ensure that the accurate diagnosis is being made and that the patient level of understanding about the disease is as good as it is at your practice than if the patient was at an academic practice with a sarcoma-specific pathologist.
Absolutely. So I think where I am, we do see a lot of a plethora of different diseases. And so our pathologists, fortunately, are very well-trained pathologists, and they'll send it out to tertiary centers for confirmation. So that is the beauty of, again, the collaboration with tertiary centers to confirm the diagnosis. So once that diagnosis is made, then again, I may reach out to you to confirm, and you inform me, did you check for this? Is there any mutations here? I do send off next generation sequencing as well. And once we kind of get that information, I'm having that conversation with the patient and informing them that this is a rare, more aggressive sarcoma. This is not kind of your typical bread and butter sarcomas. And I definitely need to refer to an expert to allow me to take care of the patient. Many of my patients do trust me. And so me being open and honest with them about even some of my limitations, I do think they appreciate that.
So I'm going to go back a few slides because I like this slide, or specifically, I like the top left-hand corner when I talk to patients. And so when I see patients that are going on new therapies, I often pull the data and I often pull the waterfall plots because I think they're very informative to patients. And so what I like to show patients is how every patient starts at zero. And then if the tumor gets worse, then it goes up. If the tumor gets better, then it goes down, and sort of walk them through this. And I think this is a very impactful waterfall plot compared to some of the other diseases we treat. And I think this is also very helpful when we're treating rare conditions to show them that they're not alone. There are several other patients with the same thing. But here, I think it's very important to look at the disease control rate. And here it's listed at 32 weeks, and that's at 26% disease control at 32 weeks. I find that impactful. Could you talk about when you see response rates in the 15% range, but disease control rates over a year at a quarter of patients? Does that encourage you to use drugs like this?
Oh, absolutely. When you're talking about these aggressive cancers where you typically only had Adriamycin, I was only able to give them gemcitabine, Taxotere. Those response rates are, you know, roughly 6 to 8 months. And so for me to have a medication, one that's orally, patients really appreciate that. For them to be able to be on something with disease control for at 32 weeks, I mean, that's impressive.
What's also nice is the 15% who respond, the time to response was less than 4 months. So what's nice is if you have a symptom, you will end up getting a benefit early.
Yes.
It's also nice for both of us when we're treating these patients. You don't want to keep patients on useless medications for a long period of time because they all have side effects, and you want to be able to pivot to something that works a little bit better. We know here that the side effect profile of the drug is a single agent, very few grade 3, grade 4 toxicity. It was just about 6% and 3% for anemia and weight loss. So when you're using a drug that's this well tolerated, because we certainly use drugs that are less well tolerated, could you talk to me about how that makes you feel? I know it's not always that we talk about ourselves when we talk about oncology, but I do think it's important when you're dealing with a lot of aggressive tumors. Look, this had an overall survival or a median overall survival of less than 2 years for young patients. So that's hard to do. So when you're able to treat a sick population with a treatment that's generally well tolerated, how does that make you feel?
Oh, it makes me feel a little bit more reassured and comfortable. I think it's challenging when you're treating younger patients and you have horrific side effects to actually watch them go through that. And even to monitor the patients, you know, some of the unwanted side effects that we see with, for instance, immunotherapies or interstitial lung disease, those are things that you don't want to miss. In this case, this is a little bit more manageable where, you know, oncologists may be a little bit more comfortable with managing anemia, I think, or fatigue. So I'm okay with that.
I think it's taking ourselves out of it is always the goal. But when you care, and I know how much you care, I've known you a very long time. When you really care, you take it home with you. And so to be able to have a therapy that you're confident in, but a therapy you also know that won't do harm is very meaningful. I have these discussions often, and you do also, where patients have have small amount of disease. They're completely asymptomatic. They've had a scan. We know there's disease. They wouldn't know otherwise. And to give a toxic treatment to an asymptomatic patient is very difficult to, for me, it's hard to wrap my mind around it because I'm doing
Absolutely.
harm and I'm not knowing that I'm doing good yet.
I'm constantly looking for de-escalation studies.
Yes, effective therapies and effective therapies that do good and allow patients to maintain function. So here we have young patients. What's the goal of young patients? They want to raise their families, they want to work, they want to live, and they want to live well. And so I think we have a therapy here that allows all that. Obviously, we want better therapies for this disease. Thank you for bringing up the use of doxorubicin and bringing up the use of gemcitabine and Taxotere for our patients. And so I agree for most sarcoma patients, including epithelioid sarcoma, there is an opportunity to give these patients chemotherapy. So here we have a 40-year-old gentleman. Talk to me a little bit about what is your approach when you're treating young patients with chemotherapy, and how does that differ than, let's say, he was 65, 70, 80?
So, I think for my young and robust patients, I'm going for a more intense regimen. And so, usually, I would use doxorubicin and ifosfamide, and if the patients are extremely healthy and they do not have any other comorbidities. If they're older and I don't think they can tolerate the doxorubicin, then that's when I'm using more gemcitabine and Taxotere-based regimen.
For a condition like epithelioid sarcoma, and granted, very rare, and we see very few of these, when you approach this with Adriamycin ifosfamide, and we anticipate the response rate is going to be less than for a patient with, let's say, a synovial sarcoma or some of the other liposarcomas or leiomyosarcomas or undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcomas, which are more common, how do you counsel this patient? Knowing full well that the likelihood of response is a little bit less than what we see for some of these other diseases, do you warn them or do you stay on the positive side and say, you know what, maybe you will do better than everybody else? What is your treatment approach?
Ooh, that is something that is nearest to my heart. I can recollect a 25-year-old patient that I recently had, and having that conversation about this aggressive cancer with the patient and my family is hard. But I do believe that, as the provider, it is your job to inform them and to educate them that, hey, this is an aggressive cancer. I do believe that you should continue to try to remain positive because it does give them a sense of hope. You do not want to take that hope away from them, but you do have to be transparent that this is an aggressive cancer with a high risk of recurrence and not a great response.
Yeah, I had a patient when I first started who probably taught me the best lesson because she looked at me one day when I probably was being negative and I'm a very positive person, but perhaps I was being negative in a situation. And she looked at me and said, someone has to do better than everyone else. And so I always think that someone does have to do better than everyone else. So there's always an opportunity for any patient to exceed expectation. So we certainly know for epithelioid sarcomas, we could use standard chemotherapies that are often prescribed for sarcomas, including doxorubicin with ifosfamide, as we mentioned, gemcitabine and Taxotere. There's other targeted therapies that are approved for sarcomas, so drugs like pazopanib. And then certainly you could start to look at other drugs off of FDA indications, which sometimes we do in clinical trials, sometimes we do off of clinical trials. When we look at the entire grouping of drugs that we have for these diseases, talk to me a little bit about how your approach is. When would you fit in something like pazopanib versus gemcitabine and Taxotere? Do you have an approach or do you sort of allow the patient to help be in the discussion of what treatments to do next?
Yeah, so I typically use pazopanib as second line therapy. Overall, to me, it does not have a really great response rate, but I do believe it's also because these patients have already been heavily pretreated with some of the medications. And this is where I do defer and collaborate with my sarcoma experts, because a lot of the times we do need clinical trials, especially if they're not. If they're not meeting these expectations with the first line therapy.
I agree 1,000%. I just want to clarify just for purpose because I don't want there to be a misunderstanding. We often use pazopanib as a second line therapy when we start with chemotherapy. In this situation, if you were starting with tazemetostat, is it fair to say you would then go to a chemotherapy based, like an IV therapy, and use pazopanib as a third line treatment?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. That's what I thought. The patient could also be eligible for phase one clinical trials. Do you have a sense of whether or not you're comfortable referring patients for phase one clinical trials?
Oh, absolutely. This is, again, a very young patient, a 40-year-old patient, and the goal is for survival. And so if there is something where we can kind of beat the standard of care, I would absolutely refer him for phase one.
What would be interesting is, so as we've seen the introduction of immunotherapy for many years now, numerous different immunotherapies have come to market. There is currently only one immunotherapy that's approved for soft tissue sarcomas with an FDA indication, and that would be for alveolar soft part sarcomas. But epithelioid sarcomas would be very interesting to get them onto an immunotherapy trial in order to see whether or not these rare diseases can also benefit from immunotherapy. When you counsel a patient to a immunotherapy, so whether or not it be a melanoma patient, a lung cancer patient, or any patient who is benefiting, do you get a sense of excitement at the possibility of something that isn't chemo? Because that's certainly what I get in my practice.
Oh, absolutely. With me treating all sorts of cancers, I have seen the benefit of immunotherapy in causing clinical remission in many of these patients. And so generally it's extremely well tolerated. And so if there is some form of a marker that allows these patients to actually have a more durable response and a response, I'm absolutely for it.
Would I be insane to say that as we see immunotherapy and targeted therapies combined in other diseases, perhaps we'll see something similar in this disease?
No, you're not insane. I think about the days when I was in fellowship and thinking about kidney cancer and receiving interferon and IL-2. And now, as a provider and seeing that we've exploded as far as the treatment options for many different cancers and the responses that we've made, we haven't seen, at least in my years of training. I think it's incredible. And so I'm extremely hopeful that one day we'll get better responses also with sarcoma.
I do believe we both are eternal optimists, and I like that. What else would you like to impart to community oncologists, academic oncologists who are watching? If we have some closing remarks, what would you like just to mention?
I would say collaborate. I am a big firm of collaboration. Do not fear the private physician because they're also academicians. We've trained at many of the same places, but some of us opted to go to private practice for various reasons. And we can still be that voice and allow that transitioning and that effective bridge to take care of these patients. And I think we should be unified and take care of them together. Develop those networks, develop those voices with your patients as well as your counterparts.
Correct. I love it. I love the word unified. And so I think if we create a patient-centric model, which we do create a patient-centric model, and we put the patient at the forefront in the middle of everything we do, and we have a rare disease like an epithelioid sarcoma, we have an effective treatment like tazemetostat, we create partnerships, we unify what we do, and we make the patient the main focus, and leaving a patient in a community to be closer to home, to be able to get home for dinner, to not have to worry about long commutes. It's so easy. And especially, you know what? We've changed the way we practice in the last 4 years. We use telemedicine. I mean, how nice for patients to have that opportunity as well. And for us to collaborate, there's cell phones and texting, and there's so many ways. There's possibilities to participate in people's tumor boards. We've come a long way, and I agree 1,000%. It's all about unity and unification. And I thank you today for coming out, for taking your time. And joining me to be able to discuss this complicated disease, to be able to talk about effective treatments for our patients, and just to talk about how we as a community could come together and we can make ourselves better because we use your strengths, my strengths, and the patient benefits for having the two of them together.
Absolutely. And thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, and hope to see you again soon.
Absolutely.
We thank you for joining us and hope you found this discussion useful and informative for your practice.